It's just we know
that when we get into conversations, I'm like, it's not good,
for
marketing, Matt.
It's not it's good showing for that shingles.
Are you going to get me a cease and desist letter?
If I don't end up with that first.
You're listening to the Roofing Success Podcast, a show created to inspire roofing contractors to achieve optimal success in their roofing businesses. I'm the host, Jim Aline, the co-author of the books Internet Marketing for Roofing Contractors and The Best Known Roofer. I'm also the co-founder of Roofer Marketers, the leading digital marketing agency for the roofing industry. On each episode, I sit down with industry leaders to talk about their processes, the lessons they've learned, and how to find success in roofing.
Yep, hey, welcome to the Roofing Success Podcast. Hit those buttons, subscribe, follow, like, all of those things. We really enjoy when you do that. The algorithm does too. So just do those things. I keep asking you. I see the numbers that of listens and plays and streams and things that we get. Not all of you are doing it. So we would appreciate it. We would appreciate it. One of the most listened episodes, I don't know if you know this, but one of the most listened episodes of the whole almost 200 episodes that we've done now is this gentleman, my friend Matt Mulholland. How are you today, brother?
Is that true?
It is absolutely 100% true.
What does that say about your audience?
It says that they're really smart. Well, what I think sometimes this is maybe a strange way to put it, but I've thought about this with you a couple of times. It's like, you're one of those people that when we get into conversations, I'm like, wow, I have a lot to learn. Like, I'm really, you know, I don't have the technical knowledge for sure, right? I'll talk sales, marketing, business all day, but my goodness, when we get into the, you know, into claims, into products, into, you know, it's always a pleasure hearing from you. So Matt Mulholland from Building Experts Institute is with us today. How's it going, man?
I'm doing pretty damn good. How are you?
Awesome. I am doing good. What's new in your world?
Oh, man. Well, we just finished up the roofing expo season. So I'm getting a little bit of time at home again, finally, at least until the PA expo season starts up, which is 2 weeks from now. We've got a lot going on different things. The Hail Canada is getting used a lot. And we're finding out a lot of stuff from that. I'm doing a lot of the private trainings right now, consultation work for a lot of people. But there's also some software things that we're developing. And of course, the Building Experts Institute has a whole bunch more courses that are being shot and everything. So anybody that's a member of that is going to get real excited about what's going on in there. I'm busy as hell.
Yeah, you always are. But my goodness, the courses that you've put together over the years, I don't hear anything but exceptional feedback on. And again, it goes back to, like, you're one of those people, like, you have this knowledge base. So we were talking kind of as we were coming on here that some of the things that you're seeing in the industry, things around like wear and tear denials and things like that. Speak to that a little bit.
Well, I mean, if any of you guys are dealing with claims, roof related claims for hail or for wind, a lot of times the adjuster or the engineer or the ladder assist, they'll say, well, that's not damaged by hail. That's not damaged by wind. That's wear and tear or blisters or improper installation or defective materials, whatever. And we all know that's just, am I allowed to curse on this show?
Yes, sure. Go for it.
It's just bullshit. It's just bullshit. We know that it's bullshit and they know, well, some of them know that it's bullshit. But that's kind of part of the thing that they have to do. So I've been teaching about this particular scenario and how it actually works, why the engineers and adjusters are saying those kinds of things, and giving some ideas of what it is that you could do against it other than just saying, you're an idiot. Clearly, this is hail damage. It looks like hail damage. But you have to understand what it is that they're saying. So if you want me to, I'll just give a little bit of synopsis of that.
Yeah, go for it.
All right, so engineers or experts that are asked to identify what the cause of loss is, causation experts of some kind, they're taught to identify what the proximate cause of loss is. And for most states, proximate cause would be the same thing or equivalent to like a primary cause of loss. This is the cause of loss that starts the chain of events off. The problem is that they're naming the proximate cause using a bad definition. So there is a technical paper that Donen writes about wind, a third technical paper on wind with asphalt roof shingles. In that paper, they talk about proximate cause, and they give this example in this technical paper. They say, imagine you're at the top of a hill and you roll a ball down the hill, and someone picks the ball up halfway down the hill and throws it through a window, breaking glass and cutting a woman's arm. And then they have to identify what the proximate cause is. Was the proximate cause you rolling the ball down the hill to start that chain of events off, or was it the person picking the ball up and throwing it through a window? According to Donen, in that example, it's the person picking up the ball and throwing it through the window. That's the negligent act that caused the damage. And I agree with that. It's 100% true. You rolling the ball down the hill does not always result in someone picking it up and throwing it through a window. The age of a roof does not always result in wind or hail hitting it and causing damage. It just gets older. But then, even though they're right in how they use that example, then they go on to say, well, if the roof would not have been damaged, except for the fact that it's old and decrepit or the sealant has degraded, then the wind isn't the actual proximate cause. It's the wear and tear, and they'll name wear and tear. Or if the nails are installed too high, and that's what allowed the shingles to be blown off this roof a little easier, and they wouldn't have been blown off otherwise, then it's the improper installation that's the proximate cause, which is different from the way they applied their example. The wear and tear and the improper installation, the defective materials, whatever, that's the condition that the roof is in when it gets its policy. People are paying to be covered for damage caused by hail or wind to their existing roof in its current condition. And the carriers are saying that they will pay for damage caused by hail or wind for that roof, and they're accepting payments for it in its current condition. That condition is not a peril. It's not an event. Wear and tear is not an event.
Yeah.
So wear and tear, improper insulation, this is the dude rolling the ball down the hill. These do not always result in hail damage. They do not always result in wind damage. Someone has to pick that ball up and throw it through a window. The shingles have to be lifted, acted on by an outside force for hail damage to occur, for wind damage to occur. That's the proximate cause. That's the primary cause. But here's the issue. And I'm just going to just keep going because you can cut me off at any point, though, if you just want.
No, keep going.
Here's the big issue. If the engineer is saying that's not wind, that's wear and tear, the problem is they're omitting that second part where they're actually saying the wear and tear allowed the wind to cause damage. And by not saying that second part, we get into problems with the insurance company, and the insurance company is going to say, well, he said it wasn't wind damage. It's wear and tear. We don't have any coverage for that in the policy. Here's the policy language that says that we exclude that. But if the expert would just continue that statement to say wear and tear resulted in wind being able to cause damage, then you would still have coverage. But because they omit that second part in their statements, we don't have any coverage. But that's actually what they're saying. So your job is just to get them to make that second part statement. You could ask them, all right, so I know this roof is old as hell, and that's probably why the hail was able to cause damage, because the hail was small. Normally it wouldn't cause damage to a roof, but because the roof is so old, it was able to. Is that why you're saying it's the wear and tear and not the hail that hit this that caused this damage? Is that what you're trying to say? They'll probably say yes, because that is what they're saying. And if you can get them to make that statement either on camera or in writing, you can go a lot further. Policies have interesting things in them called ensuing loss provisions. I'm not going to get into with your audience that specifically carve out coverage for hail or wind damage that results from wear and tear or improper insulation a lot of times. So it's bullshit, but there's ways to work with it. And the key is to get them to say that second part and not fight against them. Say, it's not wear and tear. Is to say, you're right. This roof is old. Are you saying that that's why the wind was able to cause damage? You can kind of go with it. You can lean into that particular issue and you can win.
Yeah, that's awesome. Those are, and it really, the power is in the questions, right? Yeah, but you have to know what you're looking for. You have to know the answer you're looking for.
That's
true. Is what I'm hearing. You have to get to know what the answer is that you're looking for so that you're asking the right questions of the adjusters and the people on the insurance side. Is this where a lot of the legislation is coming from, or is this along the, this makes me think along the same lines of, I don't know if it's like it's down in Florida where it's like 15 years, you got to get a new roof. And this seems to be carrying over into a lot more states. Is the wear and tear issue is or the wear and tear aspect of it, what they're trying to negate in that in the way that they're pushing that those that in their policies?
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
Because they know that as roofs get older, they become more susceptible to damage and they're more likely to be damaged by storms that otherwise wouldn't cause damage to a brand new roof. So at a certain age, they know that their risk is much higher for them to have to make a payout. So they don't want to cover roofs in full beyond 15 years. And so the roof, the rule in Florida is that they cannot reduce your coverage or drop you or drop coverage for your roof specifically until it's 15 years old or older, unless you hire a roof consultant that is approved by the insurance companies at your own cost that comes out and says that your roof has at least 5 years of life left. However it is that they're supposed to do that, because there is no standardized test to know exactly when a roof has more than 5 years of life left. I don't know. But if they say that, then you get five more years before they can drop you completely or reduce your coverages for the roof or reduce your or just remove coverages for your roof specifically. But keep this in mind. It doesn't matter how old your roof is. If you are paying premiums for coverages for that roof and they haven't written a letter saying that you have no coverage for your roof unless you replace it on this date, up until the point that that date occurs, they cover wind and hail damage that occurs to that roof in that condition. It might be at an ACV value based on different policies. It might be on an RPS schedule based on different policies. It might not be full coverage. But if they are covering the roof, then whatever condition it's in, they're covering for any hail or wind damage that occurs to that roof in its condition.
That's what we have to know, right? You have to know, and this is, you know, I see a lot of, I've talked to a lot of retail, more retail roofing contractors recently that there's now storm activity in their area. And they really have they just don't know that the insurance side of things. What are some of your kind of top things for that? For a person that's in those areas, in those markets, like these are the top things that you need to know just to have the conversation. You know, if you are more of a retail focused roofing contractor and now you're going to, you know, you're starting to see claims in your area and you want to serve your customers as best possible. What are the things that you can understand in that process to know, like, these are the top ones?
So many things. I'm trying to come up with a few top ones. I'm just going to spit some stuff out, and they might not be really the top things as they come in. So there's certain things that a lot of stormers will say, storm sales guys, that isn't necessarily true. I think you should avoid saying these things. It isn't good. You should not file claims that are frivolous claims. I don't care if it's a natural occurrence or an act of God. Filing claims on someone's policy makes them have more claims on the record, and they could be dropped if they have too many claims. Their rates can go up because they have too many claims. They are considered to be someone that is likely to file a claim, so the carriers might raise their rates. So don't ever tell somebody that they can't raise their rates just because you're filing a claim on hail or wind. That's bullshit. I hate to tell you, but that's bullshit. The insurance companies will find a way. Only in certain states is it illegal for them to raise their rates specifically for that reason. And even in those states, they just use a different reason to raise the rates.
Different reason.
So yeah. Just don't tell somebody that. You might tell them that their rates are likely to go up anyway, because if there is a major event that hits in that area, then their rates probably are going to go up as a whole in that zip code, regardless of whether they file a claim. And if they get a new roof, they might be able to get a discount, especially if they put certain types of materials on there. Just focus on what's definitely going to happen. Don't tell somebody that they're going to get in trouble or their rates won't go up. And do not throw Jell-O against the wall to see what sticks. Whoever's out there is doing that. There's a lot of you that are doing that. Please don't do that. Don't become that guy. One thing you need to understand, if you're going to claim that there's hail or there's wind damage, then you need to know how to identify. You need to actually act as an expert. So you need some training before you start knocking on doors looking for hail or wind damage, because you're going to give someone some kind of advice that's going to lead to them making a financial decision that could affect their family. You need to know what you're looking for. And there's plenty of resources. There's cheap resources. Building Experts Institute could teach you exactly what to look for asphalt shingle roofs for $109 a month. That's cheap. You make way more than that on one roof, way more. So don't skimp on the training. You need to know as much as you can. The more that you know, the reason we call ourselves Building Experts Institute is because we build an expert out of you. We can give you all the base information and all the extra information you need to really be able to stand on your own on the roof with an adjuster, maybe even teach them a thing or two, because there's a lot of stuff in there that they don't know. And you can educate a homeowner and whatever it is they need to know so they can make their proper decision on whether or not they want to file a claim or not.
That was going to say, that's really like most of the, you continue your thoughts after this, but that's what I feel like all of the contractors that I've interviewed, right? The most successful ones are the ones that care about that consumer, right? And that's, I think that's the point that I love that point, right? That you're making is if you're going to do the best for them, you have to have the knowledge to help them in that area. So sorry, go ahead.
No, I think that's extremely important. Yeah. And you don't want to accidentally screw somebody either. So learn a little bit about how the policies work. You don't have to know everything, but you need to know enough. If you're going to call yourself an insurance specialist or something along those lines, actually be one. So when you're out there and you're looking, you need to make sure that there is evidence that an event has occurred, and it can't just be on your shingles, but there's also a lot to understand about what the insurance companies are looking for and versus what the policy actually says. There's a lot of information that is just wrong. The inspectors that are coming from the carriers, they're only typically looking for cosmetic or functional damages. Based on extra contractual definitions that aren't in the policy at all. And they're going to say there's no damage a lot of times when clearly there is. If you act as an expert and you describe that damage and you identify this is damage and it's because of this, because you claimed that in a report and the policyholder sends that in, anything that's claimed has to be investigated. You kind of force their hand into actually making a statement about cosmetic damage. We found cosmetic damage on this roof. If you actually put that in writing, and it was small, roughly circular patches of granule loss only on the windward sides from a hail event that occurred on this date of loss. Here's why. If you actually put that in writing along with your photo report, not just a photo report, along with your photo report, then they have to investigate. They have to actually comment on that. You can force them to comment on cosmetic damage. You just have to do the right things up front. Most of the job is done up front. Don't play defense. Get off my soapbox for a second. I don't know what got me in this mood with you.
No, but that makes so much sense. Again, it goes back to that asking the right questions, right? By stating these things, by stating the right things in your report, you're forcing the response of that. So I don't want to say you have to know how to play the game, but you have to know how to play the game a little bit.
If it's
right?
a game or if it isn't a game, it doesn't matter. You need to know the strategies that are used against you. You need to know what strategies are successful for your clients. So the reality is, if you're hired as a roofer, then you're hired as an expert. If they are expecting you to know what hail and wind damage is, you need to know, and you need to be willing to make an opinion statement and back it up with some kind of documentation. This is where I got this information from. You can do those things, but the insurance company is only going to investigate what's claimed. You can't just sit back and let them determine what's there. Sometimes you're going to have to present the damages. You're going to have to actually show what's going on. The desk adjuster is going to have to get the same information, which is why you need to have a report, because they're the ones making the call. If you don't do these things up front, then you're going to have a hard time. I can teach you how to do it. You guys can reach out to me if you want. I teach these things to companies, private training, BEI, Building Experts Institute. Listen to this bowl. There's a lot of good information on there, all free. We can help you do the right thing, and it doesn't take a lot. But once you set up those processes and procedures, then you'll be a lot more successful, as long as you're not claiming bullshit.
Mm-hmm. What do you see most often of what you see like a roofing salesperson or a roofer looking for? You said looking for versus policy language. Where do you see the biggest gap in the inspection process from the roofing contractor and the actual policy language? What is the roofing contractor missing a lot of times?
Well, honestly, what I was actually making the statement on is what the expert or the adjuster from the carrier side was missing, because
what the adjuster is looking for.
A lot of times they're looking for
the insurance adjuster. Yeah. Got it.
So most of the time they're trying to identify what they believe is functional damage, and that's based on training that has been received from engineering firms such as Haig, Donin, Remkes, all these other companies that do training of some kind. A lot of times the definitions that are provided by these engineering firms are definitions that the engineering firm made up, not the definition that the policy has. The policy probably doesn't have a definition, not for damage, which makes no sense, by the way. It just doesn't make sense. But the courts have established what damage is according to a policy because it isn't defined. And generally that is a distinct or demonstrable detrimental physical alteration of tangible property. It's demonstrable. It's demonstrable. You can measure it. You can show it. I can see it. I can distinguish this area here is where the hail hit. This area over here, hail did not hit over here or cause damage. I can demonstrate it. It's detrimental. It got worse. The hail didn't make it better. Physical alteration. If you can literally see that it has been physically changed, that's the definition of damage according to the courts. The only way that you wouldn't use that is if the policy has a different definition, or if they have some kind of a limitation written in an endorsement of some kind, a cosmetic damage waiver or exclusion or something along those lines. Most policies don't have that, at least not for asphalt shingle roofs. A lot of different roof materials might have something like that. But there's all different things. If you've got a policy argument, though, you don't need to be making a policy argument. You need to be getting a public adjuster involved, but you need to know that the guys that are coming out to look at the property, they're not using whatever the court system definition is usually. They're using the engineering firm definitions that have nothing to do with the insurance policy. And they're not even allowed to make a statement about it. On top of that, it has gotten so bad. A lot of the IA firms, the TPA firms, the ladder assists, they're not allowed to say that there's wind damage or hail damage on a roof in their reports sometimes. If they're not allowed to say a photo and say wind damage and label it as wind damage, they're not allowed to put that. That allows a desk adjuster that also doesn't know what's going on to go, well, the adjuster on site didn't find any wind damage. Well, no kidding, because he wasn't allowed to write that in his report. Of course he didn't find any. It's pass the buck. That's the game that they play. Yeah. Pass the buck. This guy did this and he didn't report something specific that I'm looking for that allows me to provide coverage. Probably on purpose. Maybe not. We're going to use this expert over here because it keeps us from having a bad faith claim against us, because it's reasonably relying on an expert's opinion, which a jury would obviously be okay with. I mean, he's an engineer, for Christ's sake. Engineers know everything. They know how to make toilets that work in space. They're awesome. They get all the women. Engineers know everything. They, of course, know how to repair a roof and whether one is repairable. Obviously, no matter how many times they've actually attempted one themselves in the past. Which one of you is really the more expert of the two when it comes to roofing? Probably the roofer. You just got to point it out. There's a lot of stuff you can do with all of these people. It's all an upfront game. And the number one rule is don't be a dick. You need to play nicely. You need to be able to get along. You need to be professional. But you have to stand your ground on things.
Yeah, and that's kind of what you were saying. It's like if you're doing the right thing when you're submitting your upfront documentation, right, in your photo report and your report, mm-hmm. I know a lot of us weren't good at book reports in school and stuff, right? But like maybe ChatGPT will write it for you one day or something. But like submitting this upfront is working with them, right? Like it's giving them it's writing things in their language. It's speaking to them in the terms that they need to be addressed.
You're setting the terms
along the process, yeah. Right?
If you name what damage is and you happen to use in your report, I mean, that's what the engineers do. They actually define damage in their report and then they say whether they found any damage, but it's whether they found any damage that meets their definition. When you define damage in your report to be what the courts have applied, and then you found what an engineer might call cosmetic damage and it meets the definition that the courts have found, then you would be defining damage for that claim moving forward. They're going to have to investigate what you stated. And if they say, well, that's not damage, then they're going to have to back that up with policy language that they won't be able to back it up with. So you kind of set the stage. It's all about setting the stage. There's a lot that can be done. And all we have to do is actually go through the motions of doing it. The problem that most roofers have, and I'm going to, it probably feels like I'm beating up on roofers right now. Problem that most roofers have is they're in a hurry to get to the next one. But then they get mad when the claims take 8 months to a year. They hand it off to somebody and they get mad that they can't do anything with it either. Ultimately, it comes down to that roofer more often than not in being an expert. If you can slow down in the beginning, it'll speed up the whole process. You'll get paid faster. It's a slow down to speed up thing. You can put processes in place to automate a lot of this stuff. It doesn't have to be something that takes forever. It's just going to take a little bit more time up front than you're used to, but it works.
I think about the process. And then the other thing that made me think about was the who, like who should be responsible for this in your company, right? What are your feelings on that? Because, you know, a salesperson is a lot of times a sales rep is on to the next one, right? They're moving so quickly on to the next one. And that's what we want them to do.
We want them to sell.
In a lot of cases, sure. Right? We want them to sell. In your experience in the companies that you've worked with, have you seen like a structure of people and process that is outside of that you're like, yeah, you guys did it right?
I have. There's lots of larger companies out there that their sales guys put them in a contract, but they don't file the claim until somebody else comes out and investigates and makes a determination. And I like that. A lot of times the sales guys that we're talking about, you want them to get to the next sale, it's a contingency contract, and then they just happen to be in the living room while the policyholder files a claim. Obviously, it's a complete coincidence. But what if you don't know if it's a full claim yet? What if you are not really the guy that knows what you're looking for? So if you are the guy that is going to make that call, then you need to be the guy that knows what's up, and you need to be the person that can perform a full and proper investigation and be an expert at what hail or wind damage is and potentially write a report. If you're not the guy that's going to say, hey, I think you could have a claim, you should consult with your agent or take a look at your policy and determine if you want to file a claim or not. If that's you, then you need to be that expert. If that's not you, then you can schedule somebody to come in after you that is that guy. And honestly, I like the second model better.
Yeah.
Because then you have someone that is responsible for those things, and it's not a salesperson that is going to get busy. And you can have multiple people. You'll appear like a larger company anyway. I think that policyholders, homeowners, they want to feel like they're being taken care of by a large company that knows what they're doing, not just a guy that just knocked on their door. It's actually kind of weird when you think about it that the guy that knocked on my door happens to be the expert. Isn't that weird?
It's a little strange. Right. Yeah, it's a little strange.
It would make me think, is this really who I want on my roof? I've seen a lot of door knockers come to my door over the years. I love it when that happens, by the way. I mess with those guys so much. But none of them give me the feeling of being an expert. I would rather them be a canvasser and send someone that I could have a conversation with. Now, granted, I know more than most, so maybe not everybody's like that, but It just makes sense to me to be that way. I'm not trying to say anything is wrong with the sales guy doing the inspection model, but if that is the model, then that sales guy does need to know more than your average sales guy.
Yeah, but I do like I like the idea of that as a separate role.
I think so.
Someone who is really the expert in your company around this, and that's what they do. And then they are allowed to use their time not only to submit and do the inspections and submit the reports and negotiate or not negotiate deal with or the claims, right? Like they also can stay on top of all of the latest things that are happening.
Yeah. I mean, right? There's like, always that guy, right? That is really good at talking to people, great at knocking on doors. He's not the technical guy. He doesn't really enjoy the amount of time that he needs to spend on that roof. So he's going to be in a hurry. And then there's technical Tom, who's very awkward around people, but he knows his shit. Mm-hmm. You want technical Tom on that roof to really give a proper report so that claim can go well. I would rather be technical Tom myself. I was technical Tom, but I had a partner. So it was a team when I was a roofer. And this is how I hired my sales guys. When I had my roofing company, we had teams that would go out. I had a technical guy matched with a very personable guy. So I had a relationship and a technical dude. And they would go out together and they relied on each other for business. If one guy didn't do his portion of the job, the other guy didn't get fed. So it helped them not have to be self-motivated at the same time. But technical guy would be on the roof doing his thing while the relationship guy was on the ground shooting the shit. And it worked out really well.
Yeah.
So if you can't be both, then don't. I love the idea of having somebody else. It always worked for us, but it's not always possible. So it's not the end all be all, but I love that concept. And there are a lot of larger companies that are realizing that now, and they're starting to employ this methodology. So they might have one technical guy that does all the inspections for a group of 10 sales guys or so. And it's the right amount of work for them to just go roof to roof, doing this, making a quick report, moving on to the next one. Next roof, make a quick report, move on to the next one. Sales guy comes back in, closes the deal if they haven't already, lets them know what's going on. Helps them file a claim if they decide they want to file a claim.
I also think about that, like from a training perspective, you know, not all reps stick around for a long period of time, right? So you have that attrition in that, and you're all, you know, you're training new reps on an ongoing basis. To me, if you have that, you know, technical Tom on your team that can, you know, continuously be leveling up the sales team so that they can have better conversations. They can be better technically, but they have technical Tom to do to actually get the job done, right? So that they have the authority and they have a better skill set to determine, hey, Mr. and Mrs. Homeowner, this is maybe a path that we should go here or not. Instead of that, you've been shooting some shit for years now.
Yeah. I got a cannon.
You've been shooting some shit for years now. I've been at plenty of events with you where you have the cannon, you got the hail cannon out and you're blasting away. What are some of the fun things fun learnings that have come from that?
Oh, man. All right. So this is a great topic. And for background information, I have a couple of hail cannons. I started out with one called the shit cannon.
I have a couple of hail cannons.
The first one is called the shit cannon. And it's an acronym. It stands for shoots hail into things, S-H-I-T. So I shoot the shit. But then I made a smaller gun, which I call my little shit. And the gun actually rests on a whole gantry system that I built and designed, and it can be maneuvered to fire downward at different materials or at different angles. It can be angled. So I've been taking that little shit to different conventions lately, and doing a lot of amateur science and stuff with it. And it's surprising. Every time I shoot something that I've never shot before, I learn something new, or I'm able to prove that I was right about something, or I just get completely flabbergasted. So I'll give you some examples. At IRE, we were firing at different metal components. So we had a slant back box vent, a 750 vent. We had a turbine vent, and we had some gutters. And we shot the box vent. I shot one spot on the box vent real close to each other, like three times real close together. And it looked like someone jumped on top of it. It was like crushed in that area, which does happen in major hailstorms. You see crushed vents all the time. We were able to duplicate that on site. The kicker, though, is that from the very first hit, there was a crease. A lot of adjusters, a lot of engineers, they'll say that if there's a crease in the metal, that it's not hail related. That's creased. That's mechanical. Well, no, that's not true. If the metal is already bent, if the design of the metal has a bend in it and you hit that with anything, it has to crease in order to indent. It's just the way that the material is going to deform with that indentation. If it's flat or all the way across where it hits somewhere in the middle, it's going to have a very nice semi-circular indentation based on the shape of the hail. So mechanical creases might actually be caused by hail. When we hit the turbine vent, we had the same thing. We had creases across it. Now you can have tiny little hail indentations on there in the middle of a fin, but a lot of times you'll have a bend in it and you might ignore it because that can't be hail. It's got a crease in it. It could be hail. It totally could be hail. I'm telling you right now, we made those exact damages with this thing. And then we shot this gutter. We shot the inside of a gutter. This will surprise the hell out of you. We shot the inside of this gutter and it made a dent that was pea size. How big a hail do you think I shot it with?
If you said pea size, so let's shoot it piece. Let's call it pea size.
That's what I would have said. That's what most people would say, that must have been pea size hail.
Yeah.
I shot it with 1.5-inch spiky hail at terminal velocity, and I caused a dent that was pea sized in a gutter. You cannot, this is the moral of the story on metals. You can't make a determination that the damage is mechanical just because there's a crease. It just depends on the shape of the metal. And you cannot necessarily make a determination on the size of the hail based on the indentation that's there. The only real research that's done on identifying the size of hail comes from one paper called Crenshaw and Kuntz Hail Sizing It Up. They wrote it. And in that paper, they shot different metal components with hail at 90 degrees straight on and at 45 degrees with perfect spheres, 1-inch, 2-inch, and 3-inch. Three data points per material. And now suddenly everybody can determine what the size of the hail is based on the indentations. And that's just not accurate. That's not true at all. Three data points is not enough to do anything. And so all these engineers are referencing this Crenshaw and Kuntz paper, or they're referencing another paper that doesn't do any more research. It just references the Crenshaw and Kuntz paper. So there's circular references going all over the place. It's all bullshit. So then we started shooting asphalt shingles. And I don't know how much time we have. How much time do we have?
We got some time. Let's go.
Yeah, we started shooting asphalt shingles.
Are you gonna get me a cease and desist letter?
If I don't end up with that first. I hope you get it before me. That'll be great. I'm gonna hang that shit on the wall with a video.
That's right.
Haig did a study starting in 1983 that took 11 years. Now, it was originally supposed to be a 20-year study. They built these asphalt shingle roof, mock roofs. They stuck them outside in Texas. They put this metal mesh over it to protect it from hail. We don't know what the metal mesh looked like. It might have been really tight. In order to protect from hail, I would assume it had to be fairly tight mesh, so it might have blocked quite a bit of UV radiation. I don't know. Doesn't matter. They were supposed to bring it in at 7 years, shoot it, 14 years, shoot it, 20 years, and shoot it. And then they forgot. So they shot it at 0 years to get a baseline. They shot these three-tab shingles and architectural fiberglass shingles, and they shot them with 1-inch hail and 1 1/3-inch crescent-shaped hail. I don't know why the fuck they did that. That doesn't even make sense to me, or even how. I don't know. But that's what they did. And as it turns out, the three-tab was damaged three times by 1-inch hail while it was brand new, which they called an anomaly. And then the architectural shingle didn't get damaged at all by either 1-inch or 1 1/3-inch. And then at 7 years, they were supposed to bring him back in and shoot him again. But they forgot. Whoops. So 10 years and 11 months comes by, and they're like, oh, shit, we got to finish this thing up. We got to do this again. So they brought the architectural shingles back in, 10 years and 11 months old, and they shot it. But they didn't have consistent data. They didn't do 1 inch and 1 1/3 inch crescent shape again. They did 1 inch, 1 1/4 inch, and 1 1/2 inch hail. And they were able to cause damage to it with the 1 1/2 inch hail. The way that they define damage, their functional damage definition, broken matting. So it was 10 years, 11 months old. And then a few months later, they brought the 3-tab in, 11 months or 11 years, 1 month or 11 years, 3 months. I don't remember one of those two. It was 11 years old. And they shot it with 1 inch, 1 1/4 inch, and 1 1/2 inch. And it at 1 1/4 inch, they got damaged the way that they define it. Not at the 1 inch again, like they did when it was brand new. And from this study, where they're only looking for functional damage, they cut the study off, by the way. They're supposed to do 14 years and 20 years. They decided, you know what? Screw it. We're done. We're not going to do it again. They cut the study off.
It's not good, for marketing, Matt.
It's not good showing for that shingles get damaged by hail as they get older, potentially. Honestly, the data that comes from this is garbage because it got damaged when it was newer more than it when it was older. But they said from this, the rule of thumb that it takes 1 inch hail to cause damage to a 3-tab shingle and 1 1/4 inch hail to cause damage to an architectural shingle comes from this study. They never shot it with less than 1 inch. How do they know? They never even shot it with 0.75 inch. And they got damage when it was brand new at 1 inch. And then the architectural shingle only got damaged to 1 1/2, but they said the threshold size was 1 1/4. I guess they were letting it have a little bit of a cheat on there. And they only shot it once it was roughly 11 years old. So if your roof is more than 11 years old, this study doesn't apply. If the shingles that you're looking at weren't designed and produced and installed in 1983, this study doesn't apply because materials are completely different than they used to be. There's so many things that could be different about your particular situation that this rule of thumb, threshold size of damage, which comes from absolute garbage science that has anomalies that shouldn't even be used, should never be applied. And yet it's applied not just as a rule of thumb, but almost as a law. It has to be more than an inch in size to cause damage with 3-tab. It is not possible, these engineering reports say, that a hailstone less than 1 inch in size can cause damage to a 3-tab. So anyway, we redid this study. We got shingles from all over the U.S. and all ages. And we shot it with 3/4 inch hail. And we caused functional damage the way that Hakes defines it to over 80% of the laminate shingles that's supposed to take 1 1/4 inch. So surprising, we decided to send half of our shingles to a different laboratory and let them do it because maybe my hail cannon just isn't working right. Same results. And then we did it again at Win the Storm live in front of everybody. Same results. I'm going to have to start shooting it with half-inch hail to see if that causes damage at this point.
That's what I was going to say. Have you shot it with half-inch yet?
You know, I've got to 3D print a new mold and get some silicone going to get that mold done. But it's surprising. And on top of all that, really it just depends on the condition of the shingle, which is why wear and tear really is a controlling factor. It does actually participate in whether or not a shingle is damaged. But the older the shingle is, the smaller the hail it takes to cause damage to it. It's not a 1 inch, a 1 1/4 inch. That rule of thumb should be thrown out, and hopefully it will be soon. But not only that, when we shot these shingles with 3/4 inch, 1 inch, 1 1/4 inch, and 1 1/2 inch, we did 4 different sizes, we found that the 3/4 inch hail marks left on the shingles sometimes were the same size as the 1 1/2 inch hail marks. Sometimes the 1 1/2 inch hail left very small patches of granulose, and sometimes they left very large ones. There was no real correlation that could be made over what size the impact mark versus the size of the hail. It was all over the charts. It depended on where it hit. It depended on whether the stone broke apart and or bounced or crushed into the granules. There were so many different ways that damage could have been caused to that shingle. It's all over the map. So when someone says, well, that was small hail, it couldn't have caused damage, how do you know it was small hail? This site-specific data is bunk. I'm sorry. I'm going to prove it with papers, given time. But it's bullshit, and you need to be aware of it. It's garbage. But even if it was smaller, it can still cause damage. And it does. It surprises the hell out of me. Also, one last thing that we did with a cannon recently. At Win the Storm, we had Steve Patrick brought us some tiles for tile roofs. And so we had these concrete tiles. And the problem with concrete tile is that the bottom right-hand corner will tend to be broken off. And the carriers and the engineers will say, well, that's from footfall traffic, someone walking on the tile wrong, or the tiles are installed too tight, and so there's a lot of extra stress and things in there, or installation error of a different kind, or expansion and contraction making those corners. It is the weak point of the tile. Of course, that is where it's going to break. So we got new tiles that have never been installed, that have never been walked on, from Steve Patrick. And we installed them on our mock roof underneath the hail cannon, and we shot that corner one time with one hailstone at terminal velocity. And guess what happened? The corner broke off just like it always does on roofs after a hailstorm. Now, we know it wasn't installation expansion and contraction being too tight. I just installed it on that roof. We know it wasn't footfall or traffic. No one ever walked on it. The only thing that happened to this brand new tile was that a hailstone hit that corner and it broke. So for someone to tell you that that isn't hail related is asinine. Of course it could be. How do you know it wasn't? Are they just saying that the stress fractures that are in those corners make it more susceptible to the hail and that's why it was able to be damaged? And so it's the same wear and tear, improper installation argument that I gave you earlier in this segment? Probably.
That's exactly where I was going with this. This is what you write in your report, right? Like this is making sure that they are investigating. You're forcing them to investigate that aspect of it. This is a new finding since when the storm wasn't too long ago. Is this something that you feel like, hey, give this a shot in your, when, in your reports, like make sure that you're including information about this, or how would you write that language to make sure that the adjuster is, has to respond.
Have to do is make sure in your report. And by the way, keep this super simple, bullet points, because they're not going to read it otherwise. Right. Yep. But in your bullet points, you're going to say what, when, and why, what happened, when it happened, and why you think it happened. And when you're talking about what happened, then you're describing the damages. This is what we found. We like to use this definition of damage for our investigations to determine what is or isn't damage. Here's the definition we use. Demonstrable detrimental physical alteration of tangible property used by many courts across the U.S. We found small circular patches of granulose on the shingles. You could even say cosmetic damage if you wanted to. We found cosmetic damages in the form of, and describe it, small circular patches of granulose. We found broken right-hand bottom corners of tiles, mostly on the windward side. You want to add directionality to this assessment because that proves that it's probably from an oncoming storm. All of these things, if you just describe it, then that's what they have to investigate. Whatever it is that you want them to talk about in their reports that they never do, that's the stuff you put in your report up front, and they'll have to talk about it. That's all it is. It really isn't hard. I can help you develop specific templates. I can help you combat engineer reports if you want to. I do a lot of consultation. I do a lot of private training, and I do a lot of actual school training too. But if you need help, you can reach out to me. But it isn't that hard for you to figure this out for yourself either. It's just what it is that they are not saying. You want to say that. And it comes down to whoever says it first seems to win.
Yeah, you got to say it. In the other aspect of it, in the size of the hail, we had a pretty good storm come through the Twin Cities area last year. And everyone was like, it's small. Like the hail is small. My goodness, were there some claims. Like there were that, like everyone had a good year. Yep. We'll just say that everyone had a good year.
Old roofs are going to get damaged by small hail. And that's just the reality of it. Yeah, it might not look like your technical hail damage that Haig teaches. It's small circular patches of granules. And even then, if you're feeling for bruises, you'll find it. Now, here's a question that I haven't answered yet. I'm going to do some research on now. I feel like I keep taking over your podcast. Sorry.
That's what I'm here for you to talk, not for me to talk.
when there's an indentation or a bruise that's created in a shingle, and there's a deflection. And then that sits for a couple of months and it gets hot in the sun again. Does it tend to lay back flat? Are we missing the bruises and the fractures in the matting because the shingle is laying back flat? That's a question that I'm determined to find out the answer to. It's a good question. Because if that is the reason that we're not finding bruises in the field, then we need to figure that out and figure out a way that we can find those bruises even after it lays back down because it's still broken. So I've got some more shingles that are coming to me. NTSID is providing a lot of the materials to me, which is great. You guys keep using them because I get to use your shingles after you get some identification. And I need them. So keep sending them to NTSID, get your reports that you need, and then I'll get the shingles that I need to be able to do a lot of these things. And Once I fire in a control laboratory at different things, I'm going to stick these things outside and I'm going to measure them every so often. I don't know how often yet to see how deep it goes with like a depth gauge and see if it ever starts flattening out. So I got to find the right kind of depth gauge for that because if it's a shingle, I could end up bending it just by using the depth gauge. I got a little bit of experimentation to do just to figure out how to do the experiment. But once I figure that out, then we're going to have some fun. Hopefully
this is what's fun. And this is kind of to the, when I started this, I was like, it's fun talking to you. I'm like, my goodness. You think on set, but the other part of what I love about you is that you enjoy this, like the glow in you when you say you have to find this tool to like measure this depth. I love that about you, man.
I might have to design it, which is the really cool part, so.
That's right. And then, which is even funner, right? Like you might like that's what's awesome about you. What else is on your mind in the industry? Like what else should people be thinking of right now? What are some things that they can be doing? I know, of course we talked about learning already. You have some great resources for that. What else should contractors be looking at or paying attention to in the industry right now?
I think that the policies are having less and less coverage. And so contractors that are dealing with insurance claims, even though you're not allowed to give advice on the claim, I think you need to learn how to read a policy. I really do. There are too many times you're going to come across someone that, oh shit, you have an ACV only on roofs? I had no idea. And you're going to accidentally screw somebody. And they're going to be in a position where now they have to replace their roof or their insurance company is going to drop them maybe. But they don't have enough money. And so unless you're an evil corporation and that is your plan is to get them under contract, no matter what happens. I know that that's not most of you. You're not in this to screw people over. So you need to learn how to read a policy. And you need to get good at identifying some of the holes in the coverages. And without telling the policyholder what's in there, you could say many different things in many different ways to just give them an idea of what might be there. And I'm not a PA. I'm not an attorney. And by the way, I'm not an attorney. And this is not legal advice. You could say, I'm not a PA. I'm not an attorney. I don't have the authority or the certifications to be able to say this. I just know from my own experience and my own policy that reading this is what I think it says. What do you think it says? And that definitely can help things out. It'll also allow you to understand when you're being fed bullshit by the carrier and when you need to get a policy expert involved that can make the policy argument for you. And if you're a PA that's watching this, I don't know how many of your audience are PAs. Do you have a lot of PAs in your audience? Do you know?
I don't know. I'm sure there's some.
And a lot of the Illinois contractors are all PAs, right? So for all you PAs that are out there, if you don't know how to read a policy, you need to learn. I do an advanced policy interpretation webinar course roughly every other month. It's 2 days long. It will open your eyes. And we do it in such a way that we're showing the differences between one policy to the next. And every policy is so wildly different. You cannot make an assumption about what is in a policy. You just can't anymore. You used to be able to do that 20 years ago. All the HO3s were roughly the same. Now they're not. They're just so wildly different. So having an idea of what's in there can make a difference. I'm going to give you roofers an example of why you should know this. And here's something that you could use right away too. The Farmer's Smart Plan. If you have a Farmer's customer, whether it's Smart Plan or the Flex Plan, there's two policies right now. Both of them say that marring is excluded by the policy. And marring is defined as scratching, gouging, blemishes, that kind of thing. So if you have an asphalt shingle roof, which is what I talk about most because that's most things. If you have a blemish in the form of granulose on there, that's excluded in the policy. However, later in the policy, it says, oh, wait a minute, here's an exception to that exclusion. If that blemish or that marring is caused by hail or windstorm, then it's still covered. And so by knowing that that's the language that's in the policy, when I make a test square for farmer's insurance specifically, I'm writing marring really big, like giant letters, marring caused by hail. And then I'm marking all the cosmetic damages that I find in there caused by hail that everyone else is going to ignore. But that giant wording is going to end up in the ladder assist or the adjuster's photographs. And it's definitely going to be in my report that's sent in to the desk adjuster. Good luck if they say, well, we don't cover marring caused by hail. That's the specific language that's in the policy. If you happen to know that language is in that policy, you can use it. Without giving advice to the policyholder, you're just presenting damages. Is it marring caused by hail? Absolutely. So just keep in mind, someone in your company really ought to know these things and give right training and understand what should be done. Different carriers are different, and maybe you need to know how this works without overstepping your bounds, and it is a very gray line. So find out from an attorney in your state where the line really is, if there's a harder line than what I'm saying. But as far as I understand, and I'm not an attorney, if you're asking questions, not making statements, then are you actually giving advice? I don't think so.
No, I just ask questions all day on this podcast. I'm not giving advice. Matt, it's always a pleasure, man. This has been another episode of the Roofing Success Podcast.
If you would like to generate more revenue through your digital marketing efforts, please visit roofermarketers.com to get a copy of the book, The Best Known Roofer. Also, check the training section of the website for guides on everything from running effective pay-per-click ads to how to properly set up your Google My Business listing. Thanks for listening.